Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of the Sport Kite Podcast. I'm your host, Nick O'Neill, and I want to thank you for tuning in and listening. As always, if you like what you hear here, consider going to buymeacoffee.com/sportkite and chipping in a few bucks. It really does do a lot to help us keep the podcast hosted and streaming straight to you. Also, go on over to our Facebook page, look for sportkite.org, give us a like and a follow. We'll be posting a lot there for the upcoming World Kite Cup with Team USA, Sport Kite Team. And we're also going to be posting videos on our YouTube channel. So make sure you go on over to YouTube, look up sportkite.org, and you'll see a handful of videos there already. We've done a lot of work here in the past month or so to create various playlists with all the videos we found across YouTube of sport kite competition past, and they are categorized by roughly 5-year increments and divided by the US versus Europe versus Asia versus South America. So if you kind of want to go down a little bit of memory lane or see what sport kite competition has looked like over the past 20, 30 years, head on over there, check out some of those playlists, let us know what you think, because we are trying to find more and add more. We have a handful of videos here, VHSs, that we are digitizing and adding to the great video watching series there on YouTube. So if you know of a video of a competition event that we don't have on one of the playlists, please let us know. You can shoot us a message either on Facebook or at info@sportkite.org. We'd greatly appreciate sending that stuff our way. All right, in this episode, I sit down with John Baresi, who has been on the podcast previously and is one of my good friends. And I talked to him about some of the upcoming events, and we kind of look back on what we discovered when we first started out on the sport kite field and sharing some of that information with all of you great listeners. You know, the things we learned along the way that, you know, we should have started at the start, or that was very good that we learned kind of at the start. And some of it's field etiquette, some of it's approach, stuff like that. So this is going to be a multi-part episode. We're just going to put out the first part of it here and then likely release the next part next week. And then we will be doing Team USA stuff, and then the World Kite Cup episodes will be following after that, because it's only, about 15 days before we get on the plane and head on over. So with that, let me go ahead and jump into this episode. And yeah. All right. So I've got a repeat offender on the Sport Kite Podcast with me today. Would you care to introduce yourself?
Yo, John Baresi. Kite anything, kite anytime.
Well known throughout the sport kite community for all sorts of stuff, various projects you've been working on currently, driving Team Kite Life, driving Kite Forge. What else is kind of on the radar that's at the front end that you're driving?
Oh man, I'm heavily involved in Kite Forge, and I'm perpetually interested in the craft as a team and as an individual, and bending it with odd formats like dog stake. But I mean, relevant to today's conversation, competition, right? And I've been a competitor since my first one was beginning of 91. And I've been involved in the American Kite Circuit, American Kite Magazine Circuit, had a couple of international competitions. So, a 3-decade cross section of interest in the subject.
Yeah, which is like, you're probably one of the more or most experienced people that we've had on the podcast and that I've interacted with. And here I'm going to ask you about the beginning, things you've learned about, you know, through all of this time, the few decades that you've been flying and involved in the kite community, and what you've learned or what you'd like to pass down to someone who's just getting started, either quad line, dual line, just
started on the kite field, some tips, mm-hmm. tricks, things that wish I would have done this or wish I would have learned this when I got started type of thing.
Well, I think one the thing that comes up like really most direct from my heart is just based on the interaction that I've had with people about competition over the years, which is I've quite often heard that quote, well, I only do this for fun. You know, I don't compete. And to me, that's always been a conflict in terms because competition is and it can be to just about anyone fun if the mindset is right. And I think that's the capital point. So I think for a lot of people, competition represents conflict. You know, you're trying to overcome something, you're trying to battle someone or all of the stresses that go with it. And from very early on, competition for me, which is the thing that I want to relate is it was just another format for me to be able to experience kites in additional ways. So that's really what encouraged me to fly quadline more and to fly pairs and to fly team, because I was like, sweet, another chance to fly. And so I never really got wrapped up too much in competing against anyone. It was just a format to step into and I work to understand what it is that the judges are looking for. And so every step out onto the field really was just a challenge for my own ability. So that each time I'd fly, I'd learn something from it, and having the framework of competition judging gives you more to look at as opposed to just flying sort of open-ended on the field.
Yeah, I think I've heard someone else describe in a different avenue of competition, not tight competition, that they like to see the actual competition itself or training for the competition is sharpening the blade when you're a master bladesman, right? You make all mm-hmm. these blades, they're great, they're beautiful, right? And you do this thing. But until you actually really start refining edges and really start like pushing things, you won't actually see how much you're capable of. Mm-hmm. So they see it as, you know, using the whetstone and sharpening the blade. Mm-hmm. So you can really see the fine detail of the knife type of thing. And I was like, I like that kind of reference for all sorts of competition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, within that end, competition is we're sort of heading into a simpler time for competition, I think, in a good way. Back in the day, there was precision formats. There was league style precision and traditional precision, basically a whole lot of different categories. And there was a super thick rule book and a lot of things that went into it. And so now I think there's a big trend. You probably have as much insight or more than me on this, but there seems to be a big trend towards more straightforward ballet events that focus on kind of the meat and potatoes of what good flying is. Is that, you found that in your own experience?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, definitely like the pandemic was the nail in the coffin for the competition that was pretty much dying out, the style and the infrastructure that we had, and just have not seen it come back, since the pandemic hit. But what I'm seeing more of is going back to the very basic grassroots, so either it's just straight ballet, it's one versus one, or it's trick shootouts, you know, the simplest type of competition you could have, be that virtual or in person, where it's just like, okay, you do this and you do this, you do this, you do this, right? So it's not everybody gets 5 minutes and then they set up and then they do this and they do this. It's completely stripped the infrastructure away, and it's become a lot more just, I guess, organic, which I think has needed, I think most of us have said has needed to happen for a long time.
I think one of the active points is just lowering the labor point so that everybody can show up, do it with a straightforward approach, have fun, get good, good product, good results, and then, and then go on to the next one. Competition format, World Cup is obviously an international format for competition. Other than that, Competition, I think, for the most part, is non-existent in the United States. I know
haven't
it's going...
seen any in the U.S. I think I've seen. I mean, we had the winless indoor this year, but in the last year and a half, I don't have a single record of a kite competition.
Yes, certainly outdoor competition. Nothing.
Yeah.
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 So it's currently active in Europe. China right now is on the boom, from what I understand. There's a tremendous push for advancement of their own skills, their own knowledge, and they're doing that in-house and sourcing from other people. Japan seems to still be active at about the same rate that they've been for the last decade or so. But other than that, I don't know of competition anywhere else. So where I'm going with that is that I think that the rules, which is, you know, going to be one of the segues here, is how the judges are actually scoring performances. So, you know, like if we say that we've gone down now only to a ballet format, my traditional understanding of that would be that they're scoring the choreography portion at like 60% of the total value of the score that they're giving. So they have a number that they write for choreography. And choreography, of course, is content. The variety of things that you've put in, the program, as to say the kind of the flow and demonstration of that variety in a comprehensible pattern. Let's see. And then the artistry and so forth, basically the show of the thing. Traditionally for me, I've seen, I think it's 40% value on the precision or the execution, the difficulty of the maneuvers or the tricks that you're doing, that sort of thing. I haven't seen anything out of World Cup, which again is the first international overlap that we've had in a while. So I'm kind of curious as to what that standard's going to be. But although, of course, the ideologies, I think, are going to stay, no matter how you move the numbers around, the way that someone's going to approach competition is still going to be pretty much the same. But
yeah, I mean, you have enough people that are coming to the World Cup that are, shall we say, inundated with the sport kite legacy of the past, right? So they either were involved with it, or they watched it, or they know it. So they're going to be bringing a little bit of that with them. You know, there's names that have been playing and competing for a long time before the pandemic hit, type of thing. But there's quite a few new people I see coming on some of the teams. So I'm really excited to see what they bring. Not necessarily skill level wise. I'm just interested to see, like, what is the, shall we say, aura, right, around them that they bring to the kite field. What makes them the one we want to watch? Because frankly, most of the general kite community has lost a little bit of that that bar or that calibration bar, right? So they don't necessarily know that. I'll use aircraft as an example, right? Mm-hmm. That when they set that standard of, like, man, hard charging, they looked a certain way, they did a certain way, and then, like, everyone's like, oh, that's what it means to be a sport kite competitor, right? We don't really have that. So it's going to be kind of interesting to see what people bring and what becomes the thing that we all calibrate against of, like, wow, those people were really amazing. Not only did they fly well, they showed up, they set up the same way the whole time, or they were the most, you know, friendly people on the kite field, or, you know, something like that. I'm really excited to see that aspect of it at World Cup. What's going to be, like, the new thing we all look at, type of thing.
Yeah, me too. And it seems like they're the framework for that excitement is kind of in place. I've been watching some of the French Masters, and, you know, they seems like there's a more exciting vibe, certainly, that I'm accustomed to with American competitions traditionally. I'm with you in that it's kiting is chronically recreational. It's a wonderful recreational pastime, and lots of recreational pilots have the opportunity to travel to festivals and do their performances. But I think what's always made a really healthy sport is that the multi-tiering of recreational at all levels to sport, which is, mm-hmm. you know, that's somewhere is that great space in the middle, on up to professional, the people that are actually doing this full time or spending an inordinate number of hours, like really formatting and looking at what it is they're doing, as opposed to merely being a point of enjoyment. So all of those, it's just going to be neat to see that range expand even more, because that's one of the great things about kiting. Even at its apex, there's always been a space for people who just, as they say, I just have fun. I just want to go out and fly, and they can still be close to it, all the way on up to people that are pursuing some bar that only they can see, and hopefully they can demonstrate to us.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully we glean something from them. They're not sitting there trying to inspire us. You know, most people don't go in this with the concept of, I want to inspire people, right? It happens naturally. But yeah, like, I'm actively looking for who's going to be the inspiration, who is going to, but yeah, I guess that's from my history of being in kiting, my history in other sports, and then kind of the back end history of cataloging the general history of sport kiting, is I'm always interested to see what names, end up kind of at the top of the pile for inspiration and why.
Mm. So. Well, and I think it's also going to be interesting to see how it falls out in the competition with regard to, some pilots will be really, really great to watch, mm-hmm. but they're not necessarily going to score high. And then some pilots may score very, very well, but not maybe have been the most exciting to watch. And mm-hmm. so I think what one of the interesting things is what actually quantifies that difference. So like I know traditionally what I'd done as a competitor, is to try to fill the judges' buckets. So mm-hmm. if you step out of yourself as a competitor and you stand behind those flyers and you're watching, you know, so the judges, in essence, however they break down the numbers or the percentages or however they're transmitting that to a score sheet, at the end of the day, they're basically ticking off boxes. So they're thinking, okay, generally over the course of this 3 to 5 minute routine, were they generally precise? Were they coming out on their lines? Were they demonstrating the curves? Were they hitting the corners correctly? Did they execute the maneuvers successfully at a consistent ratio? So that to me is a bucket as a competitor. Any routine that I'm building, that's the way that I try to approach it to start with. So that would be one bucket. Another bucket is the musicality. So is it sort of, how to say, is it tiptoeing through the tulips? Is it going for the ride with the music? You know, yep. again, however that it actually ends up being executed. And then another bucket for me, having been on the judge's side as well, is the variety. Content. So this is going to mm-hmm. be one of the interesting things for me, I think, is vocabulary. From a competitor standpoint, I think, and I mean, how many times have I come back to vocabulary? But having a large vocabulary as a pilot allows you to demonstrate your skills rapidly and keep it interesting throughout. So when you have 3 minutes to fill, are you only doing boxes? Are you going back and forth? Are you doing some circles? Or have you built out a layer of different maneuvers, you know, 45 different things that you've just done over and over again, so they're part of your running repertoire, if you will. Mm-hmm. Let me see. Yeah, and then other buckets we're looking at is, of course, difficulty, tricks, well-executed tip stabs and landings in various parts of the window.
Those are sprinkles to me, right?
Yeah.
Like you don't need those to mm-hmm. have a killer routine. That's just extra sprinkles on top that just kind of makes everything a little bit more awesome. But it's a higher risk thing. So
it is high risk. I think sometimes it can tip the scale from first to fourth. first to fifth. Depending on how you pepper those things, it can throw off a placing by, you know, a pretty healthy amount.
Yeah. Am I going to pick the donut with sprinkles? Yeah, if it looks cool. But if it just looks like the thing fell on the floor and there's like three sprinkles on it and they look cracked open, no, I'll take the regular donut. Right. So bad comparison, but I'm hungry right now. So. But yeah, okay. So I guess we've been talking a lot about the upper level competition and stuff like this. And I know you and I have talked about, and it's been discussion in Team USA, is how we have some people that are a part of Team USA that this is going to be their first real international competition. Most of them have done demos. I don't think Brett's ever competed, has he?
Not to the best of my knowledge, no.
I know Crystal's competed in your virtual event, but...
Yeah, but that's a composed video show, correct.
Right. That's a little bit different. And I think Katrina has competed, if I remember correctly, but I don't know that Lindsay has. And so... They're bringing a performance aspect. They at least have performance knowledge and
all expertise. Of them well seasoned. Most of them with almost like 15 years, 12 years at least of serious demonstration flying.
Exactly. I don't want to take away from that at all.
No, certainly.
All right. I want to take a little bit of a commercial break here just to give a massive shout out to John Baresi, of course, but he leads a company called Kite Forge, and they're absolutely amazing. Head on over to them. They are producing both the Jin, a quadline kite, kaiju, and the Gaze. Those are dual line kites. They are great for anyone that wants to elevate their sport kite flying. So go on over there, check it out. He's got a whole bunch of them coming in here shortly, so you definitely want to see either if you can pick one up hot off the presses, or if you want to put in for a custom order, head on over there. We also want to give a shout out to Sky Shark Tubes. So if you've ever heard people referencing the tubes in their kites, the sticks in their kites as P200, P300, stuff like that, that all goes back to Sky Shark Tubes. Those are references for certain sizes and weights of the rods that we use in our sport kites. And they have really set the standard over the years. So head on over to them, skysharktubes.com. They are the best spars in the business. You really, really want to have a chat with them. And also want to give a shout out to Great American Kites. You can find out more about them at greatamericankites.com. Their mission is inspired by a love of community. They want to paint the sky with the world's biggest kites, unique views, and a dynamic experience for all ages that creates a sense of discovery and community. And they really are focused on empowering communities to soar and gaze up together. So go check them out. They are an amazing group of people that are over there flying kind of in the middle of the United States, but they're all over the US with their shows. And so, yeah, they are also another one of the sponsors of Team USA Sport Kite Team. So we want to give a big shout out to them for their support. All right, with that, let's go ahead and hop back into this episode.
But for a first time competitor, right? What is something that you would recommend, or something that maybe you learned along the way, or you wish you had learned when you first started competing?
Perpetuating the study of what program is and how to present a routine in an understandable context, being prepared for the field is a big one. And mindset is a really big one, which I think overlaps really well with demonstration and competition. How to deal with the nerves. So is sort of creating that bubble, that best space in your own head. And then at the moment that it's time to start, just finding that calm and finding that space where everything drops away and you're just doing what you do for the reason that you do it, right? So that's a big one. And I see that rattle flyers. But other than that, just having good prep is a big one. And I've seen it bite a lot of people, just not having the right equipment or not knowing how to move on and off the field. So of course, you always want to prepare for high wind. Have a B plan for that, have parts in a routine that give you an opportunity to deal with that high wind, maybe haul back in the field so you can start moving forward again, take some of that pressure off. And then having good ultralight gear, shorter lines, lighter lines, that's all of that, of course, is really important. But I think other than that, a big one for the folks that are doing it for the first time is just understanding how to move on and off the field. So traditionally in competition, and I think in essence, it'll be more or less the same in that you're going to have an arena, which is typically the flying field is somewhere between 200 and 300 feet across square. That's kind of the average of what it's been over the years. Along the side, you'll have a pit or the inbound. A lot of times they'll have the exit pit on the other side of the field. And so typically folks are setting up in the sideline, maybe two flyers ahead. And in organized competition, you've got a maximum amount of time to set up. So when one flyer finishes and the field director looks at you, which I'll touch on, they say, hey, you're up. They usually will start, I think it's a 3-minute clock for individuals. So at that point, most likely you're going to have your kite carried over the line into the field. And then from there you can launch and fly to the position that you want. You got 3 minutes to set up. You've got your ground crew, obviously have good relationships with folks
yes.
to help you.
Yes.
And develop hand signals. So, you know, a lot of times I've seen ground crew that's just over eager. And they'll run up and handle a kite without being called or let go too soon or these kinds of things. And so developing a pretty clear hand signal with your ground crew to tell them, okay, I'm good, let go of the kite, or hey, I need help. Those are the two. Touch it, don't touch it. That's kind of straightforward. Let's see. So you've got your ground crew. So you've moved on to the field. The field director, I think, is one of the most underused assets on the field. So they're your resource. You don't work for the field director. The field director works for you, in essence, not to pick up your kite or anything, but they're there as the liaison for you to communicate with the judges and the judges to be able to let you know when it's time to fly. So you can ask them for time checks. How much time remaining for setup? Even as you're moving onto the field, and they'll go, you've got a minute and 45 left. Now you've got a minute. Hey, would you give me, you can tell a field director too, please give me a 45 second warning from when the end of my setup time is over. Now, it's important to remember that it is not their responsibility. You cannot hold them liable for not remembering to do that. So it is still ultimately up to the flyer to self-manage moving onto a field. But I very rarely have not met a field director, particularly in a World Cup environment, that did not take their job seriously. So you can certainly ask them for just about any information that you need. Another good one to know about, of course, is the wind rule. However, you know, usually at the pilots meeting or the prep for any particular competition format, they're going to talk about it. But as a flyer, I've come onto the field and I feel like the wind is probably not at the minimum. I think for World Cup, the set and limit is 3 miles an hour on the bottom end. And then a maximum of maybe 22
yeah,
or 24
it's,
miles.
Yeah, it's a huge range.
It is Berksem Air. So the wind can be quite wild. But, you know, as a competitor, when you walk on the field, you reach out to that field director. I feel like it's under 3 miles an hour. I say, field director, could I have a wind check, please? And so as long as you're within your 3-minute setup still, they can hold up that wind meter and they're going to check. And if it stays consistently below that 3-minute threshold, usually the event, the chief judge has set forth some sort of a format as what they're going to do. And typically what is done is there's a slight delay if there's a precedent for the wind going up and down during the day. So maybe they delay slightly. On rare occasions, I've seen flyers be allowed to move to the bottom of the list. It's not common, but I've seen them move down in rotation so that if another flyer wants to come up and take that, they can. And then on rare occasion, you'll see it stay absolutely under the limit or over the wind limit. And then they'll just do a delay, particularly when you have a multi-day event where they can roll that event over to another day. But understanding how the wind roll works is really important for a competitor because, you know, if you have it, if it's built within the rules for you to be able to get better wind, use the system that's available to you.
It's there for you. It's not exploitative. It is designed to be there for you.
Now, I will say that there are a few yahoos out there that, you know, sometimes like to blow the wind roll away just and take the challenge. But indeed, if you feel like you need it, absolutely use it because most other people will, I'm sure of that. So, yeah, I mean, you've got the wind rule at your disposal. You have the field director at your disposal. And a big one for me is learning about that system. You know, so they usually have a pilot's meeting at the beginning of any competition and you ask them about those basic things. And other than that, professionalism is a big one. Remembering that the field director is probably a kite flyer. They're there because they really care about kites. And the judges, they're all into kites, probably at a fairly high level or very experienced level. And so having I think for me, an awareness of the field as a competitor. So when I stepped onto a field, I would like to make eye contact with the judges. I don't expect them to make eye contact with me, but if they're looking at me, I like to look at them and give them a nod. Hello, field director. Especially when I finish a routine, traditionally you'll land and then in most formats, they will say out. So as the pilot will call out and that's your official signal that my performance is now over. And then I would usually turn around and give a wave and say, thank you very much, judges. Thank you, field director. And then I would just tidy up off the field. The professionalism is really important. And that extends even into the scoring ultimately. Because the scores are going to wash out how they're going to wash out. Sometimes a competitor doesn't always understand why they got a certain score. I would hope that there's a good debrief or debrief opportunities after competitions, especially something like World Cup, where you're picking some of the best flyers that you have available in the world. And many of them, it is their first time in competition. So it's a huge learning opportunity, but you know, at the end of the day, too, there's always going to be Russian judges, to coin a phrase, right?
Yeah.
So no matter what the scores come out to be, remember that they are generated by a general format of competition, an understanding of the judges, and potentially a lack of understanding by the pilot, or sometimes own it, a failure to demonstrate the skills and all the
way that
put it. Yeah, you just didn't know how to quite put it put it on a plate for them to be able to assimilate, which is, I think, you know, that's another thing as a competitor is creating a routine, particularly ballet, is you don't want to just be going, la, 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 la. You don't want that sort of a tempo in a performance. You want to go, you know, sort of have this imagine that you have a row of check boxes in front of you on a piece of paper and you have to check them off. Leave time for the judge to, in essence, consider each thought and motion that you've done with high points, you know, and then you blast them real quick, but then give them a breather. The other thing too is that by structuring a routine like that, I'm always a big fan of chaptering. So you'll have a segment and then you land. And then there's another segment and then you stall and there's this big side slide. They're sort of cornerstone moments in her performance that when the judges are then reviewing. So most judges, I think, will make little notes on their score sheet as the routine is going along.
Yeah.
But they're just little notes and they say, oh, that was an awesome side slide, or the corners were a little loose, or whatever it is, it's going to help them. But at the end of the day, they haven't written a number yet. And so at the end of the routine, Having these sort of chaptering moments allows the judges to reflect much more clearly. And the other thing about chaptering too is that you can kind of focus your skill demonstrations into those certain areas. So here's my precision and big window area. Here's my fast, more tricky execution. Here's my more delicate, longer, slower version, that sort of thing. Anyway, I digress. It comes back to that it is a subjective scoring, ultimately. You know, they're going to try to give it some good framework, but end of the day, take the score you got and learn from it. Talk with the judges if they're willing to do so. And if you don't get direct feedback, sometimes you can get objective or general feedback. What were some of the things that you saw from the community of competitors that you think we could come back with and improve next year? So that, you know, if it's not a pick on someone situation, they can still come back and say, hey, as a general group to strengthen, these are the things everybody wants to go home and work on. That's all really important. And develop relationships with the other competitors. Be friendly, obviously, because nobody's taking home big donuts for this one. So
no,
it's for bragging rights and celebration and friendship ultimately, and to raise the sport.
Yeah, there's two things that really struck me in the stuff you said, because it's very much my approach that I teach in sports and stuff like that. First off, is the level of professionalism. It does not matter if you think the judges get it wrong. You respect the fuck out of the judges and the staff, right? Mm-hmm. Because if anything, that is going to be the lasting memory that's going to be in a judge's mind.
Mm.
If they saw you throw a fucking fit or be shitty or treat someone poorly, it doesn't matter how good of a judge they are or how good they can compartmentalize, there's going to be an inherent bias, right? Because they're going to be like, this person is a fucking douche and they're going out there, right? And they're doing their thing. And I remember they called me a nasty name last night and they couldn't spend an extra breath just to say hello to me, right? And most people are pretty good about somewhat compartmentalizing it, but that stuff sits in the back of your brain, just the same as if you make a point of being respectful to coaches.
Well, and you know, let's go in there too, because a lot of times the end result of, you know, what you're talking about is actually the final point of a cacophony of personality interactions. Yeah. So it may not be that flyer and those judges. So it's important also to remember that humanity is a library of archetypes. Okay,
yes.
That's what we are. We are archetypes, yep. Striving to be greater than the archetypes that we're driving, right? But at the end of the day, you go into a competition and you put 30 people on the field, you are going to have the absolutely stiff, serious person that feels unapproachable and is a real pain in the butt because they want to know everything about, well, guess what? We need one of those. And then you're going to have somebody in there who's just free swinging and they don't, then you have some people that are just, they're just unaware sometimes of the bubble. All of these things are going to be happening. And so I think, you know, as a competitor is you have to understand that you're ultimately walking into, you know, it is a sport environment. You're going to be dealing with all sorts of characters. And how to say, for me as a competitor, it always came down to a point of practicality. To embattle these characters is not going to provide any profit for me. Are they going to change the scores?
Nope.
Are they going to move? Are they going to change the wind? Are they going to move the field for me? What am I going to change? The only thing that I can change as a competitor is whether or not I enjoyed it and whether or not I want to go there again. Maybe that's just not for me. And that's really my problem then. It's not the judge's problem or the field's problem, because if there's probably 25 other people there that really had a takeaway from it. At the end of the day, the practical point is you take the data that's available to you. What did you learn? Did you have fun? How could you have had more fun? How could you be more successful? And that distilling of all of that experience, that when I step onto my beach here in Long Beach and I fly, all of that is with me. All that experience that I've had as a competitor, and I don't mean that like it's brought a sense of seriousness. It means that when I unroll my kite, I don't have a damn problem in the world. I roll my kite out and I roll it up with high efficiency. I have no problems because I worked with that setup time and that pack down time.
Yeah.
I really enjoy my flying. I feel like I get a great deal of expression out of it because even for myself, I'm filling buckets. I'm chaptering. I'm like, I'm going into these different realms. I'd be like, I'll sip the Guinness and then later I'll work into some tequila. It's that sort of mood thing. So it all interplays into, I think, the growth of a flyer for those that are brave enough to have a taste and take a leap.
Yeah. I just want to make it, I fully agree with you. And I guess I just want to make it clear for anyone listening that the very fine point I'm talking about is, yeah, you're going to have all those different characters, but don't be the disrespectful douche and be one of those characters, right? You can be a hard ass. You could be the, I am here. I am serious. I am committed. Mm-hmm. I need my moment. That's great. Be that. Mm-hmm. We need that, but don't be disrespectful to the staff. Right.
Yep.
And then personally, for something that I teach the athletes I work with, and granted, we play a team sport, so it's a little bit different. But I think there's still a lot of good takeaway is we harp hard on good sportsmanship. So understandably, you're doing something and something goes wrong and you just get in, you get in your fifis, you're getting in your feelings, right? And either you beat yourself up or you just feel real crappy and you're like, man, I'm just so angry. It's like, okay, you've got 1 minute to feel that.
Mm.
And then what you're going to do is you're going to turn around and you're going to turn to a teammate and you're going to say something positive to them, or you're going to positively support the other team, or you're going to do something else that pulls you out of that space. And you are not allowed to sit in that space and be negative to everybody just because you had a bad moment.
That's exactly what I try to employ at home. When I feel myself losing my shit just on something that I know I shouldn't be, go do something good. Go do something constructive.
Yeah. Honor the fact that you have that feeling. Let yourself have that feeling for a minute and then be like, okay, I'm going to go focus on this thing right now. Mm-hmm. And on our bench, we teach that you have to like be supportive of the other team. It doesn't matter if they're being shitty to you, be supportive of the other team, be supportive of the refs, be supportive of this, right? And a lot of the feedback that I've gotten from the athletes, they're like, it has completely changed how I look at the sport, right? Because now I'm not looking at enemies. I'm looking at, wow, that person beat me. How did they beat me? I want to understand why I got in this position. And so they've moved into that growth mindset better.
Yeah, well, it greases the wheels, right? Every single person in whatever position they are, or however they take that tact in their own way, it's creating a culture, right? It creates a culture. And so even the team that you go help.
All right. I hope you enjoyed what you heard here on this episode, this first part of the interview with Joan Baresi. We will be continuing it on in a future episode, so do stay tuned. Make sure you've hit that subscribe button. And again, make sure you've gone and followed us on Facebook and YouTube and all of the good old socials, because we're going to be posting a lot coming up in the next few weeks, month or so. Really look forward to what we're going to have happening on the field. And here in just about 2-3 days, we are actually headed down to Long Beach for a week-long training session with Team USA Sport Kite Team. So we'll try and report a little bit on the field from there. I hope to see you guys out on the field. I need to go pack up everything and get ready to head on down there. So I will see you on the next one.